Good morning. You're listening to Conservation Corner on 99.5 FM, KTWH-LP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. I'm your host, Emily Nelson, and today I'll be talking with Chell Anderson, who is one of two authors of the book The North Shore, A Natural History of Minnesota's Superior Coast, as well as a plant ecologist and botanist with the Minnesota DNR's Biological Survey. We'll be talking about her book, and also about water quality and Lake Superior. Thank you so much for talking with me today, Chell.
You're very welcome. My great pleasure, I'm sure.
What is your background, both professionally and also where you grew up and went to school?
Well, I am a native Minnesotan. I grew up just south of the Minnesota River in what is now part of the great metropolitan sprawl of the Twin Cities, and in a community that now is named Burnsville, mm-hmm. Probably a well-known. So I grew up in a landscape that was really different from this one, even though it wasn't the suburbs at that time. And it was a real mix of, I would say, kind of a pastoral landscape, a lot of small farms with a mix of row crops and pasture, you know, so it was still quite rural, and with a lot of remnant savanna and even little prairies still there, and a lot of nice little pothole lakes. And so it was a great place to grow up as a free range kid. I was definitely a free range child. So that's where I grew up. I went to school here in Minnesota at the University of Minnesota. And I moved to where I live now in Cook County in 1974. And I moved to Cook County to take a job with the Forest Service. And I worked in that job for 12 years. A variety of positions, but for 12 years with the Forest Service. And then I left the Forest Service and just had my own business as a consultant in everything ranging from plant surveys to forest, you know, ecology, you name it. I ran burn crews. I did a lot of different things in that role for about 13 years. Mm-hmm. Most of that work was in Minnesota, some in Wisconsin, and some in New Mexico. And then I took the day job that I currently have, which is as a plant ecologist and botanist with the Biological Survey for the state of Minnesota.
So you wrote this wonderful book, The North Shore, A Natural History of Minnesota's Superior Coast, along with your co-author, Adelheid Fisher. How did you come to know her?
Well, it was a very serendipitous thing. We never would have suspected when we met that this would happen or that we'd hatch this idea to write this book. But Heidi, she, you know, mostly goes by the name Heidi, was someone who moved to Minnesota, came to Minnesota as an adult, didn't have a lot of outdoor experience, but her husband was very interested, longtime fly fisherman from Wisconsin. They moved to Minnesota, and so she, you know, he wanted to introduce her to, you know, that experience and to a place that he loved to come to do his fishing, streamside fishing, which was the North Shore of Minnesota. So he introduced her to the North Shore, and she really just was drawn to this area. You know, she couldn't really explain why, but it just really, if it was just the happenstance, the timing of when, you know, she was ready, and she just connected very powerfully with the area. And she, although she didn't have any science background, and that wasn't her field, writing, design, art, history, those were kind of her background and her work, she was always looking for opportunities to learn more about the area. Mm-hmm. And so she had pursued the kinds of things that everyone does, you know, reading books that she could find, getting plant identification books and bird identification books and trying to learn those things and pursuing all those kinds of things that most people would do. But after some years of doing that, she realized she had a lot of questions that she couldn't find answers to. And she wanted to know more about the history, you know, and so she was looking for any opportunity to take on a project that would kind of give her a reason, you know, beyond whatever free time, you know, mm-hmm. she had. And I don't recall anymore if this was a volunteer project that she took on or if she did get paid some small amount for it, but she took on a project during this, in advance of the 75th anniversary of the Superior National Forest, to write a small, like a short synoptic history of the National Forest, of the Superior National Forest. And in the course of, you know, talking to people on the forest, she started hearing from people, oh, you know, well, if you want to know about these sorts of things, you should talk to Chell. You should talk to Chell. So someone eventually, you know, said, you should talk to Chell, and here's how to get in touch with her. And so she just called me up and said, would you meet with me to, you know, I have some questions about, you know, the forest and, you know, the natural history, and would you meet with me? This was after I had no longer worked for the forest. And I said, well, sure, you know. So that's how we met. And it all, you know, we didn't talk about writing a book that day, but we, you know, connected and had mm-hmm. many, many conversations thereafter about, you know, all kinds of things. And ultimately, I would say Heidi really, in many ways, was the needling to do this book, because she, right from the very beginning, she said, well, can you give me a list of books that I can read that will answer the kind of questions that she and I talked about that first time, or mm-hmm. when we'd have subsequent conversations. And I said, well, no, you know, they're really, I can recommend one or two, you know, that might mm-hmm. have some insights of the kind you're looking for. But I said, you know, there's scientific papers, but, you know, there isn't a nice resource that kind of pulls it all together and explains the why of things. She was ready to move beyond the names. She wanted to know the whys and about mm-hmm. the connections between things. Uh-huh. So that's how we got going on the book, because there wasn't one. And, well, maybe we should do it.
How did the two of you divide your roles in putting this book together?
Yeah, well, that was definitely the collaborative aspect was, could have been really challenging. And it's a great example of how just serendipity and good fortune really was ours, because we had maybe known each other for 2.5 years before we kind of thought, oh, maybe we should do this. And little did we know, you know, what it was going to entail. And, you know, there's just, as I look back on it now, there really is no one else I could imagine ever having done this 17 years worth of effort with. And that we were able to get a workflow that worked for us with so little real conflict or struggle. You know, I'm not saying mm-hmm. it was all easy, but we made some decisions before we ever started anything about, given how the outline, you know, that we had developed for the book and what we wanted to see included and the diversity of those topics, we knew that we want, and the audience we were hoping to reach with the book, we believed that we needed to have one voice. We didn't want this to be, you know, just a series of chapters written by one or the other of us and without some clear, consistent voice that would be recognizable throughout. And so some one of us would initiate the work on a particular section. Mm-hmm. But then we just would trade that draft back and forth many, many times. Oh, sure. And with respect to the communicating kind of, you know, I, speaking for myself, I deferred or I always used Heidi as my guide for what would work in terms of trying to communicate something complex scientifically, because she was not a scientist. Mm-hmm. And but a very sharp, intelligent, curious, and eager learner. Mm-hmm. And so if something that we put together to explain something made sense to her, then we could be assured that anyone like her with an interest in this place would probably be able to grasp it also. And Heidi's an excellent writer, so I, you know, we could always reflect on what we had done through her writer's eyes and experience. And, you know, so I was really fortunate in having someone with many talents. And mm-hmm. We we managed to pull it off.
You did a wonderful job. One of our board members brought it in to share with everyone, and I think we all have our own copies now.
That's very great to hear, of course, not especially because this is the kind of project that one does because you want to spread it's not our great knowledge, you know. We relied on literally hundreds of other people's work. This is mm-hmm. us trying to tell a lot of stories that are really based on many, many exceptional, in many cases, people's work. And, of course, the whole reason for putting all the effort into doing it is because you want other people to be able to have the benefit of all that. So much of science, especially in the past, it's definitely getting better, but so much of scientific work, the results of science, have been sequestered, you know, in professional journals and textbooks and scientific, you know, papers, and the wider public, who really needs to know just as much, if not more, than anyone, mm-hmm. really, you know, it's not that people couldn't get them or find these things, but what's the likelihood? And right. it has to be in a language and that's different. It has to be mm-hmm. told in a different way, because writing in a scientific peer-reviewed paper for a journal or something is going to be very different mm-hmm. in terms of what is expected than when you're trying to communicate with someone who may have no science background but is really interested in a particular topic. Mm-hmm. One of our many decisions we made up front was that we wanted to tell it in plain language, you know, in language that anyone who wanted to work at it maybe at times could understand. But we also did not want to dumb it down. Mm-hmm. It needed to be rigorous in terms of its facts and its accuracy. And there again, we had to, you know, we would do our work, our part, but then, you know, have people who were experts in that particular topic review the material so that we could verify that we had interpreted all this material mm-hmm. in a way that was accurate and wasn't misrepresenting the picture.
Well, I'm just going to jump in here and remind everyone, you're listening to Conservation Corner on 99.5 FM, KTWH. I'm Emily Nelson, and I'm here today talking with Chell Anderson, a plant ecologist and one of the authors of the book, North Shore, A Natural History of Minnesota's Superior Coast. And now I'd like to transition into a discussion about some of the water quality issues that you talk about in the book, including the section on septic systems. You start off that section by talking about the travel writer John Lindman canoeing down the St. Louis River into Lake Superior in the 1800s, and how he lowered a white cloth tied to a rope down into the water and could still see it in great detail at a depth of 100 feet. That's just amazing. Why is the water in Lake Superior so clear?
Well, it really ties directly to the landscape context that mm-hmm. the lake is in and has been in, but also to what brought the lake into being. And those are two very ancient forces. The volcanism of the rift, the mid-continental rift that split the continent apart in this area and made a great horseshoe-shaped gash in the continent, was kind of the initial ancient force that started to change the picture here, and that's a billion plus years ago, so that's pretty ancient. Yeah. And the second big force that then changed the picture dramatically again was the repeated glaciations of this part of the continent. Mm-hmm. And the most recent of those glaciations ended about 15,000 years ago, or began to kind of leave the stage about 15,000 years ago. And the repeated glaciation, so there were, I don't know, maybe 30 over many, many millions of years. And each time a glacier, you know, moved into this area, it reshaped the substrate that it found. Mm-hmm. and, you know, scooping and gouging and dumping, and, you know, think of it as a, you know, massive earth-moving machine. So each one of these glaciations made the land different. And each one of those glaciations, what it left behind is kind of a mystery, except for the last one, right? Because mm-hmm. they were always reworking what the previous one right. had done. yeah. So, but we some things we could know would be consistent among the glaciations, and that is that there are certain rocks in our landscape that are much more resistant to the glaciers grinding and pushing and shoving than other rocks. And so what we see now, or what we saw after the last glaciation, was shows us evidence of that same variation. So the basalt that is along the lakeshore and the basalts and other very erosion-resistant rocks that create the big ridges that are at the heart of the big ridges that parallel the lake were really resistant right along to glacial movements. Whereas the rift, the area that the rift had created, this big low area, right, that subsided after the rift, likely, we know, collected a lot of sediments along the way because it was a basin, you know, or it was a depression, and all as water moved off, you know, the land in between the glaciations, mm-hmm. a lot of sediments and finer materials would have moved into those low areas. So the glaciers, when they then reentered, would be pushing that material around. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what the most recent glacier did, was that it really gouged out all the sediments that had mm-hmm. been deposited in that basin and moved them out to different parts of the surrounding, what's now the surrounding landscape. And as it receded, mm-hmm. it left behind a big, more or less empty, uh-huh. but quickly filled basin. And so the water that we see out in Lake Superior today is primarily ancient water. It's the water that melted from that glacier as it moved away. So glacial water, cold, relatively clear once the sediments precipitate out that might be held in it. And in Lake Superior's case, because of the depth of the basin, and there's a lot of depth to the lake, and that helps maintain the cold temperature because you have not only a lot of water, but a lot of deep, you mm-hmm. know, deep areas in the lake. So the lake loses its heat pretty slowly, and it's in the middle of the continent right. where we have where we don't have very long summers. Mm-hmm. So that's a part of why the lake is the way it is. The lake also, because of its coldness, is often talked about as an oligotrophic lake, which is low productivity, cold, usually clear water. And it's that low productivity, that lack of things growing, you know, in the water itself that are a part of that clarity. So because there's so little, comparatively speaking, little life in any little bit of water, there isn't much to mask our view down into the water. But the fact that the lake is an oligotrophic lake or a low productivity lake does not in any way, shape, or form mean that it's not a very complex and dynamic ecosystem. It just means that it's a radically different mm-hmm. ecosystem than a lake, an inland lake, than Lake Mille Lacs, than, you know, most of our inland lakes in northeastern Minnesota even. Mm-hmm. So we shouldn't interpret, as it's sometimes done, oligotrophic as just a big kind of empty place out there.
Yeah, just cold, clear yeah. water with yeah, nothing right. alive. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And how did the human uses around Lake Superior contribute to the water quality and clarity of Lake Superior, especially compared to other Great Lakes? I know there are higher population densities as you move east, as well as agriculture.
Yeah, so that goes directly to another aspect of what makes the lake the way it is, or has, and still does in the case of Lake Superior. And that is that if we look at the Lake Superior watershed, which I'm sure all the listeners are familiar with the watershed concept, that there's really a very low proportion of land to water. So the majority of of the watershed is the lake. Yeah. I think it's 1.5 to 1 is the proportion of land to water in the Lake Superior watershed. In the rest of the Great Lakes, it's more like 6 to 1. Oh, so really? That's a huge difference right there, right? Yeah. So we have a very small, relatively small amount of land that's inputting things into the lake compared to the other Great Lakes. So that's a big difference right there. Yeah. But as you suggested in your question, what happens on the land in any watershed is reflected in the mm-hmm. water. And in the other Great Lakes, because of the terrain left behind by those ancient forces of fire and ice, yeah. the land there and was much more accessible and amenable to lots of human uses that never really took off in the Lake Superior watershed. So a big one still today is agriculture around the other Great Lakes, and then industry of all kinds, in many cases heavy industry. So our human uses, whether it's septic systems, where we started this conversation, or a pulp mill in Ashland, or farms, large agricultural operations around Lake Michigan or Lake Erie or Lake Ontario, those are all potentially contributors to changing the nutrient inputs into the watershed that they're located in. And in the case of Lake Superior, our low population, which you also mentioned, and then the lack of changes to the landscape, permanent conversions to the landscape from forest to agriculture or from forest to human habitation, large cities and larger communities, and the lack of heavy industry, too, all mean that in terms of the inputs off the land to the water are much less altered. Now, they're not exactly the same, but they're much less altered here in the Lake Superior watershed than they are in the other watersheds. And we know from evidence in other parts of the Great Lakes, for instance, Lake Ontario, that all of the Great Lakes, with maybe the exception of Lake Erie, which was kind of a middle productivity lake, probably right from the beginning, but for all the other lakes, they all were more or less this cold, clear, you know, oligotrophic kind of ecosystems. And we know that there's good evidence from Lake Ontario, for instance, where even in the 1800s, changes that happened just over the span of a few decades in terms of forest cover, and these weren't conversions to big cities, they were just extensive changes to the forest because of timber harvest that was happening, you know, really everywhere at the time, that in and of itself, over the span of just a couple of decades, really flipped the whole ecosystem on its head. So these lakes, like Lake Superior, even though Lake Superior is so vast and so huge in terms of the amount of water, that in and of itself can't protect the lake from the same kind of change happening over time.
We have a lot of forests up here around the North Shore. How do forests impact water quality?
When we think of forests and water quality, I think it's really important to right away note that forests aren't just trees. That's often, you know, kind of, I think, how people, you know, want to picture it. Obviously, you say forest, oh, yeah, trees. And that's really an important aspect. But forests aren't just trees. They themselves are individual ecosystems, and they aren't all the same. And that's definitely true of the Lake Superior watershed and even of just our Minnesota portion of it, that we have a lot of variation within the Lake Superior watershed in terms of our forests. And a key element in terms of relationship between forest and water and Lake Superior that all of them share is that they receive the water that mm-hmm. comes from the atmosphere, and that they have an influence on it. And where forests are intact, as in, and functioning themselves as ecosystems, they are going to slow the movement of water from the land to whatever the receiving body is, either the initial receiving body of a small wetland or a small lake or pond, all the way to the streams, and then those streams down to Lake Superior. They're going to slow the movement of water, and they're going to cleanse the water as it goes along of things that can precipitate with the rain onto the land. And they're also going to prevent water, more often than not, they're going to prevent water from moving through the system, our riparian systems, our rivers and streams, at really, really high volumes, such that the volume of water is going to do significant damage to the stream channels and to be eroding banks and creating a lot of sediment that ultimately will be delivered both to other parts of those streams, but also ultimately to the lake. So they're influencing in a very dramatic way the movement of water, and that ultimately means that it's influencing the movement of particulates of all kinds into the lake. Lake Superior, we know from sediment cores in Lake Superior that because of its small amount of land, and in our case forested for the most part before European settlement, that the sediment coming into Lake Superior once the land had been vegetated was infinitesimally small. I mean, think of micron width bands of sediment. I mean, this is many, many times narrower than your fingernail in terms of sediment for a year. So really, really tiny. And so sensitive, I mean, that's so small, that we can see the change that's happened at certain points in time when there was dramatic changes to the forest cover. Mm. So you can see an exponential growth in just that sediment layer in the lake as a result of the dramatic loss of forest cover, both due to harvest and then fires in mm-hmm. the basin, you know, early European settlement era. Yeah. So you can use the sediment layer, because it's so sensitive, you can use it, even in a lake like Lake Superior, to, you know, as markers for when certain things happen. So that's a big function of forests and water quality and Lake Superior's ecosystem. Another important aspect is that forests are, on the one hand, they're controlling the movement of some things into the lake, but they're also contributing mm. things to the water that moves to the lake. So if you think about a stream now, most of our North Shore streams, you can walk up a stream like the Temperance River or like the Beaver River, or mm-hmm. and you can, you know, enjoy the scene, and when the water's low, you know, you can walk right up the stream bed. It's a pretty easy trek. Well, chances are that's not how it used to be. Except for right down close to the lake, where we get into the steeper terrain and, you know, waterfalls and those kinds of things. Forests really contribute a lot of coarse woody material to streams, because trees age, trees die, they get sick and die, so they fall into the streams, and they created a lot of important stream bed habitat for the life that's there. So they created a whole structure themselves within our streams that then allows a whole ecosystem to develop within the stream, along with the contours of the stream bed itself, whether it's got pools and runs, or if it's boulder bed, or so there's all a whole array of smaller ecosystems within each of those habitats of life forms, plant and animal life forms, And the forest contributes to that too by the leaves that it drops, by the coarse woody material it puts in. So part of the function of the forest is to contribute a certain level of nutrients and particulates, organic particulates, to the streams flowing into Lake Superior. And the nearshore environment in particular of Lake Superior, which is the hotbed of productivity in our lake, in those nearshore habitats, that flow of the right amount at the right times of year of nutrients into the nearshore part of Lake Superior are essential to the productivity of the lake in that nearshore zone. And like I said, that's the hotbed. That's not the only place where there are nutrients being recycled and growth is happening at the primary level, and then that's being translated into the rest of the lake ecosystem, but it's a very important one, especially with respect to fish and some of the organisms in the lake that we're most familiar with and pay the most attention to, I guess. So the forest isn't just about slowing the water down. It's also about making particular contributions to the water that ultimately moves into the lake.
Wow, that's really interesting.
It is. It's incredible. It's just incredible. So, and our different forest ecosystems within the watershed range from kind of conifer, especially prior to settlement, conifer-dominated, more well-drained, sometimes very shallow soils, so where the water would have moved off very quickly, wouldn't have done a whole lot to slow the movement of water. But other places in the headwaters, the most interior portion of the watershed, have very deep soils, but they're much better drained than some soils you encounter closer to the lake. Yeah. So each of these different and unique forest systems that are a part of the Lake Superior watershed have slightly different, influences and are connected in different ways with respect to what they contribute to the lake.
Turning the focus now to septic systems, you had written that in 1991 there was a large survey done of septic systems along the North Shore from Lester River to the Encampment River, and they found that a very high percentage of septic systems, over 50%, were failing, and that included the newer mound-type systems. Do you know what's been done since then to improve the situation?
Yeah, I think both Lake and Cook counties, which are really the North Shore counties, there was additional work ultimately done, by both counties to really try to address those issues and look for ways to identify the failing systems, then work with the landowners to replace the systems. I'm not sure about Lake County, but I know in Cook County, they established a revolving loan fund so that people who couldn't easily afford, the high cost of replacing a failing system could have access to no interest money to do that and pay that off over time. And I think, to my knowledge, that there's been a lot of improvements that have taken place in both counties. And there's just much more regular oversight now of septic systems and when they're installed and what's needed and what's possible. There are some sites, not just along the Lake Superior shore, but even our inland lake shores, that really aren't suitable for systems of one kind. So we have to look for a system that will be able to accommodate the needs at a particular site. And that's something that's, really was not appreciated and followed through on in the past. But I think since those failing systems were brought to light and the concerns that creates, because as I said, those are directly impacting the nearshore zone with nutrients that are very harmful to the lake ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So I think, yes, there have been improvements. We can always do better. People need to be not just have a good system installed, they have to be good at stewards of their system. You can have the perfect system, but if you don't take care of it and you don't operate it correctly, or hire someone else to, you know, monitor it for you, if you don't feel comfortable doing that, then it isn't going to work. And yeah. So it isn't going to do what it needs to do. And mm-hmm. all of your investment will be wasted. Yeah. And the lake will be imperiled. So we individually also need to take that kind of responsibility in living up here in most places, not everywhere, but in most places. We can't just leave it to the municipality. We have to take responsibility for how we manage our waste, our septic systems, how we use water from our wells or from the lake, how we manage the land that we own. What do we do with our trees, with our shrubs, with our lakeshore, with our, you know, woodlands? Yeah.
I was surprised to read that if the septic system is functioning properly, it can result in water that's higher quality than water treated at a municipal facility.
Indeed. Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
That we as individuals can aspire to, you know, setting really the gold standard for mm-hmm. water that is moving into the lake. Yeah. And that really, you know, in my opinion, if we're someone who says we love Lake Superior, that's the least we can do. Is to, you know, take care of our septic system so that it's doing what it's meant to do.
And you wrote that it's not just our lakes and streams, but also groundwater. Malfunctioning septic systems can leak into our wells, contaminating the water that we use in our homes and for drinking.
Right, yeah. And nobody wins. There's really no winner in the scenario where a septic system that's properly built fails. There's no winner there. And it's something that we, you know, I think more and more people understand that. I think there's more education via the counties and others to try to educate landowners ahead of their, you know, getting their septic system built, and much more involvement with septic contractors so that there's a better standard of quality for the building of septic systems. You know, I've lived here a long time, and I can assure you that there are a lot of different ways that it was done, you know, building the same quote-unquote system, but, uh-huh. you know, some done well and some done very poorly. And so there's a higher standard now, and I think that's all helping, for sure.
I'm just going to jump in here and remind everyone, you're listening to Conservation Corner on 99.5 FM, KTWHLP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. I'm Emily Nelson, and I'm here today talking with Chell Anderson, a plant ecologist and one of the authors of the book North Shore, A Natural History of Minnesota's Superior Coast. Another one of the things I wanted to talk about, Chell, is the idea of diverting water from the Great Lakes. There are several regulations and agreements that regulate our use of Great Lakes water. Can you talk about those a bit?
Well, fortunately, we're very fortunate that far-sighted individuals and communities made the choice to work at an international level, because our Great Lakes are international bodies of water, to think about protecting both water quality, because we have international treaties that govern, you know, inputs into the lake, mm-hmm. State, you know, regulations as well, and national regulations. But we also have agreements about taking water from the lakes. And when a compact like that, the Great Lakes Compact was first proposed and being negotiated and discussed, the main issue that people were considering trying to kind of get in front of, instead of being behind the curve on, was projecting ahead and thinking, well, is there going to come a time when communities, either within the basin or even outside the basin, just outside the basin especially, would be struggling to find water, whether it was for agriculture or for drinking, you know, whatever use. And so that was really what the focus was. How do we want to make sure that we don't want to set up something that is an absolute barrier, you know, and say no way, we're never sharing, you know, just forget about it. That wasn't the approach that was taken. Was more, no, we're not going to preclude the possibility of sharing the water with some other place, some other watershed, basically, or with someone in our watershed, but we are going to put some limits on what can be shared, how much can be shared, and then have some criteria that you have that some, that a proposal has to meet in order to for we, all of the provinces and states around the Great Lakes, or a particular lake that's being, where something's being proposed, have to meet, a project has to meet those criteria for us to consider the proposal. And then the criteria, also set of criteria that has to really be satisfied in order to be considered. And for something to go ahead, everyone has to agree that it will go ahead. So it's a joint body that gets proposals, but then each of the individual states and provinces has to ultimately decide if they're going to say yay or nay on a particular proposal. And the main thrust of the deliberations are going to be about proposals that are for watershed, different watersheds, where the proposal would move water from, say, Lake Superior or Lake Michigan or wherever into a different watershed. So you're really extracting the water, and it's not coming back. It's not going to be put on fields that are within the Lake Michigan watershed and ultimately, you know, have the potential to move back into the Great Lakes or, you know, stay within the watershed. So these proposals that are outside the watershed are the ones that are, especially right now, there is one, Waukesha, Wisconsin, I think it is, that is out there and that will be the first real test of this concept. But once, when those agreements were first reached, there was also something that, you know, evolved and occurred that no one really had anticipated and was the first test in a different way. And that was when a company wanted to take water from Lake Superior onto a big ship and move it out of the Great Lakes and bottle it and sell it, you know, to some other part of the world. And that, you know, I think at least the people who were part of the original idea about this, no one, you know, there was no such thing as bottled water, you know, at that time. And, you know, so the idea that someone would be, you know, selling millions of bottles of water was, you know, what, you know? I mean, that came along after this had, you know, all been sort of set in place. And so it created a huge uproar and a tremendous response from many different points of view, but a very great concern of, well, if this was a proposal to a Canadian government, but, you know, all around the basin, it was, wait a minute, we can't, you know, you can't just say yes to this. This would open a huge, you know, Pandora's box. And how would you say no to anything, you know, after you did that? So that's so ultimately that went by the wayside. That didn't happen. But it's an example of how there are many things we don't foresee. There have been people since then who have proposed, well, we should have a pipeline from Lake Superior to Arizona or to, you know, parts of the Southwest where, you know, they're quickly are using up the water that's available to them and their populations are growing. And so these are potentially profound moral questions that we living in these watersheds could be faced with. If you have people who have no drinking water, it's not an easy, you know, just, oh, well, forget about them. I mean, that's not a simple, for most people, that would not be a simple decision. Of course, you know, we also have every reason to expect that people everywhere would be doing what they can to conserve their water, use their water wisely, and not thinking that, well, we'll just bring it from somewhere else. And that isn't always how it works. But, but we should have that expectation. And we should be doing it ourselves.
Yeah.
So just because we live on the biggest, by volume, freshwater lake in the world, doesn't mean that we don't have to think about how we use our water.
And I was so surprised to read in your book that only 1% of Lake Superior's water is replenished each year through precipitation and from streams and groundwater inputs. The vast majority of the water has been there for a very long time.
Yes, right. And that goes back to that small land, amount of land, yeah. with, you know, compared to the size of the lake. So it's a tiny mm-hmm. bit that's that's coming in. So it's not an endless supply. It's not an infinite supply. Yeah. And, you know, that doesn't mean that there isn't water to be used. But we have to mm-hmm. we have to really think carefully and be cautious about what we do with our water and what we put in the water.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. Thank you so much for talking with me today, Cho. And thanks to our listeners for joining us. Conservation Corner is produced by Lake County Soil and Water Conservation District with funding from the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment. This is 99.5 FM, KTWH LP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. I'm Emily Nelson, and I hope you have a wonderful afternoon.